Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Stopwatch.
Stopwatch who?
Stop what you're doing, because the Revolution Watch podcast is about to begin.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the Revolution Watch podcast. My name is Kevin Kuro, and joining me, as always, is my colleague Stephanie.
Hello, guys.
Hey, Steph, what's up?
We're good. If you've noticed, we've been away for a little bit of time.
Yeah, okay, but there's a real good reason for that.
So we've just moved offices in Hong Kong to a new space, so that took some time off our already pretty busy schedule. So we decided to take some time off. Also, Kevin and I were separately on holidays.
Well, sure. Why are you laughing? Anyway, people who know us know why we're laughing. I just want to quickly talk about the new space we have, because it's quite nice. Like, we're able to kind of create our own like podcasting session here, so we're able to control also the ambient noise. So hopefully the sound will be better in the upcoming podcasts.
Yeah, and that means we also have more flexibility to record podcasts on a more regular basis. So hopefully you guys keep on listening. We have some pretty exciting content coming up.
Yes. Before we actually start the podcast properly, I want to mention something that made me very happy, is that I had a few people come up to me and mention that they listened to the podcast, and they gave us very good feedback and comment about it. Someone recognized me just from my voice, saying that he was able to, you know, just hear me talk, and you know, he was able to recognize that it was my voice and came up to me and said, "Hey, are you Kevin from the Revolution Watch podcast?" Said, yeah, I didn't know. I recognize your voice.
Well, that's... Yeah. So yeah, shout out to Daniel. Cool. Thank you for recognizing Kevin's voice.
Yeah. So no, we're just very happy because, you know, obviously we spent some time producing and editing this podcast. So when you have people come up to you and telling you that they like what you're doing, it's always a good feeling.
Yeah. Also, feel free to leave comments or any feedback on on iTunes reviews and all that kind of stuff. We'd love to hear from you and see how we can improve on the podcast.
Yeah, and if you have any suggestions in the future, you can always just go in the comments on our Instagram page when we post about a new episode. You can leave a comment if you have suggestions of subjects, themes that you want to hear in the upcoming episodes. Please feel free. I mean, you know, we're always happy to hear suggestions from people.
Yeah.
So our Instagram is revolution_HK. So go check out our page and give us a like at the same time.
So our guest this episode is Maxime Plasher-Bucci, who is an ambassador with Hublot. And he was in Hong Kong recently to release the new Sangbleu 2 watch, which is the follow-up to the pretty popular Sangbleu original watch. We speak with him later on this episode about his Swiss upbringing, the worlds of graffiti and body art, and his many passions. And of course, why he's returned with a new and improved Sangbleu watch.
Yeah, because apart from being a tattoo artist, he has his hands on a lot of different subjects. So we'll touch on that with him, and hopefully you'll enjoy the conversation.
Before we jump into the interview, we have some pretty big news to share with you guys.
Well, you might have heard it by now, but we have a new member on board in the Revolution family, and it's none other than Adam Craniotis, who's been appointed as editor-in-chief for Revolution USA.
Adam Craniotis is the founder of Red Bar.
It's a very popular group of collectors who come together to share their passion for watchmaking and watches.
Yep. We actually have a very in-depth interview our founder Weiko did with him over on our website. So we'll share a link in the podcast notes and you can go check out the interview. And so without further ado, here is our interview with Maxime.
All right, so we're sitting here with Maxime Plasher-Bucci, who is a tattoo artist based in London. And so, as I just said, you are a tattoo artist, but you also wear many hats in your daily life. Do you mind quickly introducing, in your own words, who you are and like all the different aspects of who you actually are?
You know, in a nutshell, we mostly work in design and art related things. There's tattoo studios, there's design studios, publishing. I would say this is mostly creative direction. Agency kind of work is just the general field we're in, with a certain amount of products we produce as well. We have three tattoo studios at the moment, one in Zurich, one in London, which was the first one, one in Los Angeles that opened recently. We have I have a company called Swiss Typefaces in Switzerland, which produces typefaces. So we design fonts, among others. The numerals on the watches that I designed are part of, were designed by my company, but a lot of other things as well, from the eBay logo to the Dubai public transports and things like that, are all projects of ours. And then we have a whole publishing and media side of things with Sonbleu, which is a sort of legacy thing, as Sonbleu actually started as a magazine, as a publication that I started about 15 years ago, as I was pretty much shortly after I graduated. And it sort of became all of these other things, but we still have a publishing side with Sonbleu Publishing. But mostly Sonbleu is now a creative direction studio agency. We've done music videos, we do fashion branding, all kinds of things.
And so do you consider yourself more primarily a tattoo artist, a designer, and just an artist in general? What are the...
I don't really think in those terms, so I don't really have an answer to that question. Okay. Everything I do has a certain amount of vision behind, and someone once used a term that I like very much. It's in German. It's the Gesamtkunstwerk, which means there's no real translation, but it means work of art that is gathers a lot of things. Right. And to me, that's I've never been good at labeling.
Right, you don't want to box people. Yourself in one thing.
No, right. I'll just go with the flow.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're based in London, but you studied and you actually grew up in Lausanne in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I think London and Switzerland are two very different places.
Mm-hmm.
Which do you identify with more? Like, did you find London was the environment that fit your personality more, or?
Yes and no. That's actually a really interesting and big question, because it is something that I think about a lot. And, to me, Lausanne and London is not that different. Essentially, I as soon as I could, I traveled within Switzerland, then outside of Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
in Europe, continental Europe, then London, then the US a lot, now I come to Asia. I feel that a pretty strong European identity for sure,
mm-hmm.
With a very strong American influence, but also I realize now that, I sort of embrace the input and influence from anywhere else, from mm-hmm. Being in Asia is extremely inspiring. I feel that I really started thriving once I was able to move, mm-hmm. and it's not one or the other, it's together that all those different locations, different places, different people, different cultures that I started really where I fit is in that sort of movement, and it's not about choosing one place. I choose to travel around and sort of live that kind of lifestyle that is very unique to
mm-hmm.
this moment in history, I find.
Mm-hmm.
Did you draw inspirations from both places as you started, getting more artistic and drawing and after tattooing also?
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, once again, if you want to get into the detail of aesthetic, artistic influences, I would definitely say that overall, I've probably been more influenced by Switzerland and sort of central northern Europe kind of artistic culture. But then with very early on as well, that sort of very strong Anglo-Saxon influence, not as much as far as design and shapes or, you know, the expression itself is concerned, but much more in the way it is managed and in the way the expression is produced and then contextualized. Mm-hmm. And having been involved in you know, American subculture type things from a very early age, so we're talking about, you know, skateboarding in my childhood, and mm-hmm. we're talking about the mid 80s and then hip hop from probably the late 80s onwards. I would say that I always took the things that I had around me that I couldn't understand very well, so from medieval, you know, cathedrals and monuments in Central Europe, mm-hmm. to modernism, to modern and contemporary art, things that I saw around me growing up in Europe. But then I always apply that sort of hip-hop kind of approach, right, and very sort of American mentality to the way I handled those things and appropriated those mm-hmm. things. And in that respect, London is, or the UK, but London was a very sort of a happy middle between mm-hmm. that these sort of, and the environment, the artistic, the formal environment that I grew up in and that I knew the best, mm-hmm. but then with that extremely dynamic society and open-mindedness, although it's expressed in England very differently than it is in the US, but that I needed mm-hmm. because I could never fit in the sort of extremely rigid structure that was in place and still is in place in Switzerland, for example. Mm-hmm. And I had to leave. I could not fit there. I could not be part of that. But I could take all the good things that I studied and saw and understood from that background and bring it and sort of reappropriate it in a much freer, dynamic way that I got from that sort of Anglo-Saxon influence. And right. You definitely feel that sort of the sort of the convergence of those things in the UK, mm-hmm. And that's why it worked out so well for me for a decade. And once I sort of managed to set up my own world within that, mm-hmm. And especially a world that is very international, very globalized, then now I get to go anywhere with it.
Right. What is the confinements you were talking about that you experienced in Switzerland?
Well, that would be an hour yeah. or more conversation by itself. But what I would say is, you know, I can sort of summarize it by the way, but by one example, there's in Switzerland a lot of public funding for arts and design, mm-hmm. but to apply to any subsidies, any grant, then you have forms that you need to fill out to, right. you know, apply mm-hmm. for those things. And so many times I downloaded the forms and I tried to fill them up, and a lot of those forms are just, you know, just boxes to tick mm-hmm. and to explain what kind of project you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having to create my own little box, like literally, right. like, sorry, my project does not fit in any of the of right. the above. Mm. This is what it is. And obviously you never hear from those people after that. Uh-huh. And I'm not talking about once, I'm talking about, you know, five, six, a dozen time that or other grants in Switzerland or whatever. And, you know, there's a point where, you know, if you're not wanted or if you don't fit somewhere, there's a point where, you know, you need to also get the message.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry, but I'm just going to just note something as well, that in some ways it was also something meaningful to me to come full circle with that. And to me, getting to work with Hublot mm-hmm. was a very nice, sort of pleasant and comforting way to
to feel that I hadn't completely, you know, it was just a matter of context, a matter mm-hmm. of time, that at a certain moment I couldn't necessarily do the things I wanted right. to do in Switzerland, but then I never gave up on mm-hmm. keeping in touch and sort of keeping this thing. It was not like a divorce. It was just like, okay, I'll be right back.
Right. You were just a bit ahead of your time.
Possibly. I'm not sure it would work today either. Mm. But at least, you know, I did find with that something that from an emotional, from a personal point of view, was extremely meaningful to me and was probably something that I was hoping or looking for as an opportunity to sort of, go back and recreate some sort of tie mm-hmm. to Switzerland.
Mm. So do you feel that Hublot is doing something quite different from anyone else in the Swiss industry that you can see right now?
Yes, I definitely feel, the watch industry in itself is extremely, it's something that is very strangely disconnected from all of the other industries in Switzerland, mm-hmm. which, mm. you know, has a lot of pros and a lot of cons as well. And there's a few little attempts now to for the watch industry, that the watch industry does to connect with the things just around them, mm-hmm. You know, the Swiss culture and Swiss industry and all kinds of, there's historical reasons why, you know, the watch industry is like that, but there's no reason why it should still be like that today. I mean, historically, it's not, doesn't mm-hmm. come from arts or design. It comes mm-hmm. from, you know, manufacturing and craft at most. So there's historical reasons on top of geographical reasons to some extent, because the Jura is a bit isolated,
mm-hmm.
just even geographically speaking, not Geneva so much. But so there's the situation of the watch industry in itself, and what is interesting is that for this reason, the watch industry also happens to have been for now a long time much more open and focused on the outside, mm-hmm. and eager to be in that sort of, you know, globalized trade culture, and representing something that goes way beyond the borders of Switzerland, and that has been for one or more centuries now. So there's something that's sort of structural open-mindedness going on in the watch industry in itself already in some way. You know, it's much more conservative on some mm-hmm. aspects, but at least as far as going beyond the Swiss, the limitations of the Swiss borders, that is definitely already the case. Whereas if you look at Swiss arts and design, maybe because of all the subsidies and things, the abundance of funding for arts, which, you know, most other countries will be extremely jealous of. But then what it does is that people don't have to hustle ever. Mm-hmm. They never even have to try and sell themselves outside of you know, their little region mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right,
and most of the best artists I know just pretty much, you know, earn a comfortable living from either teaching or the subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there's nothing wrong with that. But once again, in terms of, you know, open-mindedness is not necessarily the best. So that you have that situation of the watch industry itself, and then within the watch industry, I feel that probably because Hublot is also a relatively young brand
mm-hmm.
that was created, or like as it was mm-hmm. Appropriated by Jean-Claude Biver in the beginning, it was already with an extremely, you know, post-Quartz idea of what a watch brand is and should be,
mm-hmm.
Embracing all of the experiences Jean-Claude Biver had done before. And and I think that the fact that this brand was created like this was in fact structurally extremely positive.
Mm-hmm.
And so for this reason, I feel that on top of the watch industry itself being more open, quote unquote, certain aspects than traditional arts or design, in Switzerland, Hublot is within that by so far the mm-hmm. most open and daring brand that, you know, at the end of the day, there's, you know, whether people are keen to, ready to recognize that or not, but the influence in the past 10 years of Hublot on the whole watch industry mm-hmm. and the definition of what luxury sport, you know, quote unquote, sport watches are is tremendous, and is the same, it's probably on the same level as the legacy in terms of shape and structure as you know, the base that Gerard Argenta set up. Mm-hmm. When you look at the way people use materials today, it would never be like that if it wasn't for Hublot.
Yeah, for sure. Did Hublot approach you, or like how did you guys meet?
Yeah, they approached me.
Okay. Okay. And because you're Swiss, and I'm assuming you have family or friends around you who are in that industry, did you have a passion in watches, or did you like watches to begin with before this whole
I don't necessarily have people directly related to that. My father's a journalist, and he covered a lot of the sort of 90s, you know, early 90s sort of quartz crisis mm-hmm. and the rise of Swatch, for example, and a lot of Jean-Claude Biver's early endeavors. Mm-hmm. So I remember being a kid in the early 90s and hearing about those things. I remember I remember very clearly. But there's no one directly in the watch industry. But what it does, I often compare the watch industry for a Swiss person to what probably the car industry would have been to a person who grew up in Detroit, mm-hmm. You know, some decades ago. It's just there. It's just people live off that. And it's not about the culture of watches. It's about the industry. It's not about, you know, this or that brand and the legacy, blah, blah. And it's about just people going to work every day. Mm-hmm. And if a factory closes down, then it's a problem. It's the mm-hmm. things people feel very attached to. It's in industry. It's real. It's on every level. So, you know, just the taxes alone of the owners just mm-hmm. feed entire villages or yep. towns. Do you know what I mean? So it's something that people feel extremely strongly about. And then I grew up with a grandfather who was a local GP at in a town in the Jura, who had a few nice watches. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very much a patriarchal symbol and something that, you know, people knew the names, etc. All the name of the brands, those who bear actual family names, mm-hmm. you know, that the names that I grew up, that were people with those names mm-hmm. in my schools or around, not right. necessarily with any relation to the brands themselves, but it's just local names, which is mm-hmm. kind of hilarious mm-hmm. to me retrospectively. Some of them as very sort of rural names, right. and I never perceived as something extremely necessarily classy or whatever. So that's kind of funny, but yes, I would say for these reasons, it's something extremely meaningful, and even if you don't have a passion per se, I personally had a real interest, a real passion right. for it from an early age. But even if people who don't will feel that it's meaningful and, you know, that is relevant to who they are symbolically. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I think we're going to just back up a little bit to maybe your beginnings before you went to tattooing. I read that you were inspired a lot by graffiti. Mm-hmm. I think at early age. Is that what made you want to become an artist, or is there something else that made you want to become, you know, to a certain extent, a tattoo artist?
Okay, so I was not influenced by graffiti. I was doing graffiti, so I was doing it, and it's not really the shape, the aspect, the aesthetics of graffiti that I found interesting. It was the sort of performative side of things, right. that just do it, you know, kind of thing. I did graffiti because I loved art, I loved drawing, I loved self-expression as a kid, and then growing up not necessarily in an artistic environment, you know, there's like, sure, there's ways to do things. Of course, I could draw on paper, etc. But once you sort of go beyond the obviously the idea that you're not supposed to be,
right.
You're painting on the wall, then it's just there, and it's much easier to access than, you know, getting the knowledge necessary to paint oil on canvas or whatever. That's something that was just there, and I could see people doing it. It was, once again, it was in the very early 90s. It's hard to imagine probably to people today, but if you go on Google or whatever, look at archive images, European cities were covered in graffiti, mm-hmm. in the early 90s. Yeah. But I'm talking about covered. This is something that people tend to forget probably, and obviously now it's a while ago, but up until the late 90s, early 2000s, graffiti was a huge thing. It was everywhere, and as a kid it really struck me. And I would say before that, skateboarding was already that, so it has the same dimension of appropriation of your environment. You just go and what is something that people should sit on, actually you can do something else, mm-hmm. with it. You can go skate, you can jump on it, you can, and this idea of going beyond the sort of codes of society was something that appealed to me, because I was too limited otherwise, and I didn't really have, mm-hmm. any way to express myself. But I could see that, you know, some other people were doing this, and it was not that harmful at, mm-hmm. the end of, right. the day. And I tried, and later, this is this sort of idea of just doing it was definitely one thing that appealed to me with tattooing.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of performative and the importance of the performance.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is the thing that is fascinating about graffiti, equally fascinating with graffiti and tattooing to a large extent, is the simple idea that someone's ready to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If not more, but at least as much as the result itself.
Mm.
And this is something that I definitely struggled to find once I graduated from art school in the sort of day-to-day reality of working as a designer, graphic designer, whatever. I never felt this sort of straightforwardness, this sort of, it's not just about, it's not really about transgression. It's much more about the how much people care about doing a tattoo. This is something that there's no reason to do a tattoo except, mm-hmm. that you want it. It doesn't, right. fix anything. There's no speculating on it. There cannot be any ulterior motive,
mm-hmm.
to tattooing. And there's something amazing about it. There's something, mm-hmm. that most other fields and design and lifestyle service products are hoping to get this sort of intensity, and they don't. And tattooing does have that. And graffiti, to a large extent, has that, had that as well. So I definitely sort of found that in tattooing later, and this is to me the red thread or the linkage between these different cultures that I place myself to belong to and approached and then appropriated. That's probably the
mm-hmm.
the red thread.
Mm. Then do you find designing a watch quite different from graffiti and tattooing?
I don't, because the way, in fact, it's very similar, conceptually speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You deal with a lot of given pre-existing physical but also intellectual aspects.
Yeah.
You have a thing that has a very precise function that, mm-hmm. that you cannot move any little bit in a movement or whatever, or you can, but it comes at a great price, or in the structure of the function is present in a watch. There's only so much and so much leeway you have to move and to affect those. And on top of that, then there's all the projections of the people who are going to see it, and all the preconceptions and the expectations of what a watch is, what it should represent, how it, you know, fit in the lineage of the watch industry and whatnot. And in that respect, working on someone's body is very much the same. You know, there's only so much you can do. It's going to affect the person's image. Is it going to affect it in a good, bad way over time? Mm-hmm. Is it durable? Does it work with movement? You know, what's the visibility, the legibility? All of those things, you find them, you know, and with graffiti, if you go on a building, it will have its own shapes, it will have its own, you know, and how, once again, legibility, the visual impact, but what it means, how it's going to affect if you do a graffiti on a bank or on a residential building or whatever, it will be perceived differently. So all of those things, and the same way you do a tattoo on the same tattoo on someone's, I don't know, forehead, on an arm will look completely differently. And that's the same way with the watch. If you know, that it's such a little details that all of a sudden will make a watch look more dressy or more sporty, or for this kind of person or that kind of person. And people will put a lot of, as soon as it exists, the amount of projection, the amount of energy and thinking that will be, you know, cast on those things by the audience, by the people who come across the product or the piece, will be tremendous. And this is this sort of thing, and they can't be controlled, as they you know, if you show in a museum or gallery an art piece, then you can just, to a large extent, you can understand and predict who will end up seeing the piece. And you can create a piece with those people in mind, and it's all about a sort of dialogue and a push and pull control of who's going to see it in what order. So there's that critic is going to legitimize it so that everyone else can see it in a certain way. And that is interesting in, as far as fine art, contemporary art is concerned. But with any applied art, design things, or, you know, it's hard to put graffiti or tattooing in those categories, but somehow they have the sort of aspect. And in this case, you're just showing it to the world. And then you need to deal with the consequences of that. So it has, so your understanding of the sort of semiotics involved in those practices are extremely important. They're probably 70% of your quality, of your skills, are not the execution or the design. They are your ability to understand how it's going to be read and understood, and interpreted, and how it's going to impact people. So, so definitely, you know, that's how I see.
How many versions of the Sangblu watch did you design before you were happy with it?
It was a completely fluid process. It wasn't really versions, revisions. It was a continuous back and forth. With the first one, you know, it was a lot of sort of, from my side at least, because no one had really worked with a tattooist in that sense. People had, you know, a couple of other brands had taken tattoo motifs and just slapped them onto watches, but that's not what I was trying to do. And I told the people, I remember my first meeting at Hublot, you know, they were talking about tattoo watch and this and that, and I was like, you know, guys, look at my work. You can take that work and put it somewhere else. It doesn't look like a tattoo. This is what I do. And the reason why I was a bit, you know, special as a tattooist is it's exactly because of that, because because I brought motifs and things that were, did not belong to the tattoo iconography in the beginning. And so so if you decontextualize again my design, then you sort of lose that tattoo element.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And immediately they were like, oh, no, don't worry about that. We want to work with you. This is, it's not about tattooing, blah, blah. This is, it's about you. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, then we're talking. But nonetheless, I would say after that, I was still probably trying to, this is probably my design training. I probably try to cover the, you know, a few different grounds in terms of just checking that they didn't want to sort of tattoo design slapped onto the watch. So I just, the way I usually work is I just go as far as I can in all directions and create, you know, very sort of rough sketches of all the different directions, but like very clear different directions for people to choose and ensure that, you know, they're not ambivalent. This is a kind of almost Rorschach test, you know, sort of show people. Sometimes I'll also show things that have nothing to do with actual sketches, like if I have the time or... and so, but immediately they went for, you know, they were very clear, like I was doing the sort of more geometric sort of styles that I do. I do other things as well, but I do that, and I just took a design I already had and put it on the watch pretty much and sort of just adjust it so that it didn't look too weird. And that was obviously the sketching phase. And immediately they said, we're interested by that. And I was like, okay, wow, we're actually talking, like right. We actually have, you know,
something
it's concrete. Actually going somewhere interesting. And after that, it was just purely sort of fluid back and forth kind of thought process, continuous train of thought, really. I couldn't really say in terms of revisions, in terms of versions. To me, although the Semble 2 does not replace the Semble 1, but as I showed you earlier, it's actually based on the same structures. It's just sort of evolution. To me, it's almost like, you know, those scenes in cartoons when a character gets run over by a car or whatever, and they're flat, and all of a sudden they pop up, and they like re-inflate or whatever. To me, it's almost that. It's almost, you know, taking the 2D elements of the first version and making it 3D.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at every point I see something and I will have another idea, or I see something that should be fixed or improved, and given the opportunity, I will. I think, you know, I could have continued to just strictly improve the first design, you know, indefinitely almost, and now we already have a second design, hopefully more. But yeah. So I'm trying to have in mind both the sort of increments of improvement, but also cross that with the fact that I don't want one to replace the other, although the first version is now no more in production, and so effectively kind of replace it. But it's also clearly to me a sort of idea of creating a line, because I believe in this enough that I think it should actually exist in all kinds of, for all kinds of different contexts, from very simple, dressy, whatever, to all the way to much crazier, and a bit like the new one is, and I think it could be even crazier than that. So I try to have both of these strategies in mind when I design, and especially with that, I hope that's where it's going.
So going back to your design, you said you didn't want it to be just a tattoo design slapped onto the face of the watch. And so for the Sampler, like both versions, the design of it actually tells the time, like it moves to tell the time. Was that your idea, or whose idea was that?
Yes, absolutely. I found some references during research. Well, so first of all, I studied graphic design and semiotics of all kinds
to me, the idea of displaying information is very mm-hmm. interesting. And the other thing is, I definitely, unless I had been forced to do it, I probably would have, but sort of reluctantly. It was very important for me that my intervention would be structural. It would be mm-hmm. I wouldn't be adding a layer. In fact, I would only be working with elements that are structural. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely my own personal briefing, the brief I gave myself, and then I found some examples of historical watches that had attempted to use the hands as a sort of different shapes, etc. Mm-hmm. So then we had to deal with the technicality of creating much larger, therefore heavier hands that could create, you know, mechanical issues, and even, you know, there's a little bit of push and pull there and compromising. But I have to say, and this is like, you know, just giving credit where credit is due, that Hublot just took the idea and at some point, you know, just made it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember seeing, I mean, of course I had, you know, designed the whole thing but the day I saw the first prototype of it was so much more than my 2D designs. Right. And this was where the magic happened. They mm-hmm. really, they did their job to such an incredible extent, and hopefully I did mine as well. Mm-hmm. But so that was, once again, it was very, like, they really did everything they could to make it happen. That was incredible.
Mm.
As an artist, what do you feel when you see your design that is usually meant for, you know, being permanently on a body, on a skin, and then you start seeing it on objects? Does that give you a different feel to what you normally do as tattooing on a body?
Yes and no, because they're not meant to be on a body. They're meant to exist by themselves, pretty much. And they existed before I started tattooing. I only started tattooing in my late 20s, early 30s, and I had almost a whole career before that already. And if you look at a lot of things that I did before at art college, you already find a lot of those things that are applied to other supports, other contexts.
Right.
So to me, I mean, I'm not, I don't want to sort of, I don't know, no, you know, not say that it's an incredible feeling, because it really is, because in terms of the amount of craftsmanship, the amount of attention to detail that you have in a watch is something that, you know, I've designed books, I've designed clothes, I've designed all kinds of things before, but there's never, you know, a page is a page, it's a fairly basic thing, is a sheet of paper with ink on it, and you know, the fanciest that you can get with a book is not even scratching the surface of the amount of skills and you know, attention to detail that you have in a watch. So in that respect, it definitely opened up a whole new world. But I wouldn't say it felt completely natural, and that was the beauty of it. Right. Immediately felt like, to me, and hopefully but I think that's once again when things clicked, is that it felt completely natural to everyone, and I never felt like lost or unsure about what I was doing. I felt perfectly confident, and when I saw it, I was like, yeah, that's what it should be. And but I would say also from the point of view of sort of career point of view, it was a statement, and that was amazing in the sense that that was also a way or an opportunity to show that, to demonstrate that the way I approach things can be expanded and applied way beyond what people knew me best for. So I would say from a strategic career point of view that it was not deliberate, but it, I just took it, you know, and ran with it. But
But I realize now retrospectively that it was a huge turning point in showing that, demonstrating that.
Mm. Right. Usually tattoos are very kind of like an emotional thing, you know, to get something in for life on your body. Which ones are yours that you feel are the most important?
On myself?
Yeah.
It's not... I can't really answer that in the sense that I don't really think about my tattoos as things. To me, it's the process of getting tattooed that has been incredibly important because it sort of was my first step becoming what I am today, and it opened up doors for me that changed everything or made everything possible. Not changed, but reveal the potential that I was sort of looking to realize. And but to me, it's just being tattooed, it symbolizes that. But beyond that, I don't really think of my tattoos at all.
What about your first tattoo? When did you get it? Or who was the artist who did it for you?
It was in my early 20s. It was on my back and arms and legs, pretty much. It was a very large piece that got tattooed by a man called Philippe Leu, how it's pronounced in French, who was in Lausanne, but also turned out to be an incredible artist, very, very, very important artist, who then took me as his apprentice. Mm. And that was so that's why I'm saying it changed my life, but it's not the motif itself. I don't, if I got tattooed today, I would get something completely different.
Right.
But it would probably have the same result.
Right. So it's the whole experience, the performance of
absolutely
getting the tattoo.
Yeah. Right. Just literally pushing the door to a whole new world. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was, it was like a Doctor Who experience of entering this, this tattoo parlor. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, that's where that's where I belong, pretty much.
Right, right.
And that emotional connection that happens between someone who gets tattooed and the tattooist, is that why you think celebrities sometimes go to you or other famous tattooists, is to have that special emotional connection with you, maybe?
I hope so. I think that there's a beauty as well in tattooing both for a client and for a tattooist as well. As of today, you're still, that no one's going to do the tattoo for you, so you can be as cool as you want, but you're still there doing the tattoo, and if you ask for $1 million for a tattoo, then you're not going to tattoo anyone. So you're never going to be in a little ivory tower, and I think that there's that sort of very grounding aspect of tattooing, both of the sort of unique experience of getting tattooed in general for a client, for a customer, but also as a tattoo artist, you can never not have your feet to the ground in that perspective. Or I guess some people sort of start specializing in, very, very VIP, etc. experience. It's still an extremely, I feel that people who can afford like top premium luxury experiences in general, they already get that. Mm-hmm. And I feel that this is probably, even to people who could afford like, I feel that this grounding, this very, very real experience of getting tattooed is actually, it's something that is very healthy, both to the tattooist, as I said, but also to all sorts of clients, from the most VIPs to the most everyday people. And this is beautiful. This is what I want to see. I want to, in my studios, you'll see all kinds of people, and that's how I like it. That's how and this is the strength. This is where people meet, and there aren't that many places in the world anymore where all kinds of people will meet and see each other and be at the same place at the same time. Mm-hmm. And there's a
there's something really beautiful about it. But there definitely is a bond. There is definitely something extremely special. I mean, I spend sadly, but I probably spend more time with a client than I spend with my own children in a day. So, you know, obviously, it is what it is. But what I mean by that is that a certain intimacy, a certain proximity exists, and you cannot not take it seriously. The person will give you even much more than the time that the tattoo takes, but will take, you know, the entire lifetime where you change the way they look, and they'll probably think about you very often after that. It's something absolutely incredible, and that nothing else except, yeah, family, marriage, children probably brings to you. And once again, that I feel the easier it gets to get products, to get services, to get to any kind of consumption in this society, the less people put emotional value in what they get, because there's less effort in getting things. And I feel that it leaves more room for experiences, for things that are not material or not like functional services or whatever. And this is very much what a lot of people look for in the experience of tattooing.
Do you yourself collect watches?
I do, yeah.
Is there any specific brands?
Or models or
kind of things that you're attracted to?
I don't think it's appropriate for me to name drop. But but what I would say is that there definitely is a heritage, and the heritage is the 70s, 80s luxury sport watches.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The Gérald Jontard heritage, I would say, is definitely where most of my sort of tool, you know, watches that are meant to be worn, meant to sort of accumulate
mm-hmm.
history by being worn a lot in all kinds of situations. That's definitely, you know, the red thread in my collection. And you know, I wear all the watches I have. I enjoy seeing them
mm-hmm.
live and be affected by time and things around them. I don't particularly enjoy vintage. I don't enjoy the idea of... I like the idea of vintage, but it's not my thing. I don't want to take someone else's history. I want to create my own. Mm-hmm. I want something, you know... I cherish a couple watches I got from... as, you know, inheritance or whatever, that this is what's meaningful to me. And I don't, I have this very pragmatic approach to collecting. But yeah, I would definitely say, you know, I still to this day do a lot of manual stuff, from art to tattooing to, mm-hmm. I'm a very active person. I have children, I have a very active life, and I want watches that can withstand my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I don't watch is that I just go look at with a loop, you know, at the end of the day, and mm-hmm. be like, oh, now put it back in the safe.
Right.
This is not the way I look at things. I hope that people wear the watches I design as well. They're meant mm-hmm. to be worn, and however challenging it might appear to read the time, it's actually easier once you you know, look at it.
Once you have it for a while,
being after 15 minutes, you'll be perfectly yeah. fine by the time.
Yeah.
But they really meant, and this is sort of closing the circle there. To me, Hublot, by dealing with tattooing, does connect with the future in the sense that that tattooing itself is at the beginning in some ways of its life as a mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. It's only the very, very beginning, and it's going to grow, and it's going to be
to establish itself progressively as something that is pop in the mm-hmm. noble sense of the term, that is a culture that can be appropriated by anyone if they want or not.
And we're back. So that was our conversation with Maxime Pleschat-Buchy, who talked to us about, you know, his collaboration with Hublot, his new Sembleu de watch. And we really hope that you enjoyed this conversation. It was very in-depth. We really touched on a lot of subject here.
Yep, he's super creative. He has so many projects going on. It kind of makes you feel like, what are you doing with your life?
And then he just has, obviously you can't really see, but then he has like a very cool look. Like he arrived dressed up in white of like, you know, all his tattoos and that stuff. You know, it's just like you have a cool vibe just as he enters the room.
Yeah.
So before we end this episode, let's quickly talk about the Only Watch 2019 auction, which is taking place in Geneva on the 9th of November.
So for those of you who don't know, Only Watch is a charity auction that happens every other year to support the Monegasque Association Against Muscular Dystrophy. This auction is supported by so many watch brands, and this year it will be hosted by Christie's Geneva, and all the watches will tour around the world before the auction in November.
Yeah. All right. So let's go into our picks. So obviously, like you said, there are 50 lots. The one thing that's stood out to me is the Tudor Black Bay Ceramic 1. So Tudor has a watch that's already pretty much dark in color. It's the official watch of the All Blacks, which is the Tudor Black Bay Dark. But the Tudor Black Bay Dark, the normal model, is a steel case that's treated in a black PVD coating. So here, for Only Watch 2019, Tudor came out with a Black Bay Ceramic 1. So this takes like the Tudor Black Bay Dark to another level almost. First of all, this case is ceramic. It's actual black ceramic. And the case back is the part that's in steel, encoded in black PVD. What you have also on the dial is like an all black theme. I don't know how easy it's going to be to, you know, read the time on it, but honestly, from the pictures, it looks really cool.
So one of my first picks is the Jaeger LeCoultre Master Ultra Thin Perpetual Enamel Chestnut. What really jumped out at me is the brown color of the dial. It's such, I mean, we only see the pictures right now, but it's such a beautiful, rich, chocolatey brown that I really like. And I mean, JLC has been doing some great things, some amazing things really this year with all the novelties that we've been seeing come out of SIHH. This watch comes with the new perpetual calendar caliber that we've already seen before. So the only difference in this unique piece is the chestnut dial, which I really like. It's handmade guilloche enamel made by the manufacturer Craftsman.
All right. What's your second one?
The other one, I think I'm just going through a brown phase or something. But the second one that I really like is the Breguet Type 20. This vintage-inspired manual-wound flyback chronograph. And I think the Breguet Type 20 that is in production nowadays use an automatic movement, but for this Only Watch 2019 auction, they use the Valjoux 235 movement, which is quite cool. It's a column wheel flyback chronograph, like I said already, and the dial is this bronzy brown color that is really nice against the steel case, I think, and obviously it's a pretty wearable size at 38.
And I think we can't really talk about the Only Watch auction without the two, you know, heavy hitters of the sale. So the first one, you know, Patek Philippe, mm-hmm. they just know what people are gonna go crazy for. So here they take their Grandmaster Chime watch, and they just, you know, case it in a stainless steel case, and with a salmon dial. I mean, you know, this one is people are just gonna go crazy for.
Yep. And can I guess what your second one was?
All right, yeah.
Is it F.P. Journe?
Yes. So the watch features astronomic prototype movement in 18K rose gold and a blue chrome dial. So it's kind of on par with what he's done in the previous auctions.
Mm-hmm.
But then the amount of complications that you get on it, it's quite incredible.
Yeah, so he's kind of one-upped himself from the previous action.
Randomly you get day and night indication, sunrise and sunset, moon phases, power reserve.
And in the on the back,
yeah, on the back,
the annual calendar,
yeah,
and the equation of time,
You get the tourbillon, the 60 seconds tourbillon. You get also the remontoire d'égalité. You get a meter repeater as well. That's just throwing in there. Why not?
So all in all, a very cool watch.
Yeah, the estimate is between 300,000 and 600,000 Swiss francs. That's probably going to go. If last edition, the watch sold for 1.5 mil, this one's probably go, way above its estimate for sure.
So this is just the initial feedback and the initial reactions that we have upon seeing the list for the first time. But check back on our website. Stay tuned because we do have an interview with Luke on the website.
Yeah, and as soon as we're able to see the watches in metal, we'll go and take pictures and share them with you on social media and our website. So stay tuned for that too. And yeah, that's it for this episode. We really hope that you guys enjoyed it. Please leave us a rating and comments on whichever platform you get your podcast. And please drop us a note if you want to, just to say hi on our Instagram page.
Ciao. See you guys next time.
All right. See you guys. Bye.